Stein's Sunday Poems.
Here's some rhymes for the times as we go from bad to verse. It is August, which is an odd name for a month. No, not because it's neither a Nuary or an Ember, like January, February, September, November. I know it was renamed from Sextilis in the year 8 BC by Emperor Augustus to commemorate his imperial majesty and the season of his great triumph, such as the conquest of Egypt. But I mean, the word itself is hard and somehow unpoetical and sticks out if you try to put it in a lyric, for example. The exception that proves the rule being Cole Porter's You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To Under an August Moon Burning Above. What a magnificent choice that word burning is. But here is a poem for August, a Canadian poem as it happens. Sir Charles G.D. Roberts is one of that quartet of writers born in the same decade as the Dominion of Canada, and who in consequence are called the Confederation Poets. He was one of the first Canadian authors to gain an international reputation, and in fact was called the father of Canadian poetry. King George V knighted him in the Silver Jubilee honours of 1935. He was born in Douglas, New Brunswick in 1863, but whether you are in that part of the world or some other in the northern part of the Northern Hemisphere at this time of year, you will recognise a lot of the detail the poet observes. First published in The Book of the Native in 1896 by Charles G.D. Roberts, an August Wood Road. When the partridge coveys fly in the birch tops cool and high, when the dry cicadas twang where the purpling fir cones hang, when the bunch berries emboss scarlet beads the roadside moss, brown with shadows, bright with sun, all day long till day is done, sleeps in murmuring solitude the worn old road that threads the wood. In its deep cup, grassy cool, sleeps the little roadside pool, sleeps the butterfly on the weed, sleeps the drifted thistle seed. Like a great and blazing gem, basks the beetle on the stem, up and down the shining rays, dancing midges weave their maze, high among the moveless boughs, drunk with day, the nighthawks drowse. Far up, unfathomably blue, August's heaven vibrates through. The old road leads to all things good. The year's at full and time's at flood. Thank you. Matthew Nelson on clarinet, Jason Harding at the piano, and a piece from 1872, the first of three fantasies by the Danish composer, wait for it, August Vinding. I said the word August was in some sense not very poetical, so there are very few pieces called August, but there is a Danish composer so-called. The very same year, August Vinding composed that piece, 1872, 150 years ago. There was published an anonymous volume of poetry called Flyleaves. Actually, it was by a fella called C.S. Calverley. Who's that? Well, he was born Charles Stuart Blades, because his grandfather had decided to change the family name from Calverley to Blades. But the son and grandson decided to revert, and they changed it back from Blades to Calverley. C.S. Calverley wound up at Cambridge, and after Sir Charles Roberts being the father of Canadian poetry, if you look Mr. Calverley up in the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica, Arthur Waugh calls him, quote, the father of what may be called the University School of Humour, which I think may be rather less of a compliment than being called the father of Canadian poetry. Mr. Calverley's poetry is little read these days, but he is still a presence in Cambridge at the corner of Rose Crescent and Market Hill, where the tobacconist shop Bacon's stood until 1983. It's now rather boringly a branch of French Connection, I think. But at the corner of Rose Crescent and Market Hill, there is a plaque bearing some lines by undergraduate Calverley on the joys of tobacco. Cats may have had their goose cooked by tobacco juice. Still, why deny its use? Thoughtfully taken. We're not as tabbies are. Smith, take a fresh cigar. Jones, the tobacco jar. Here's to thee, Bacon. Droll. Here's to thee, Bacon. Doesn't work as here's to thee, French Connection. Here's a rather cynical poem, but the ostentatious musical comedy rhyme scheme helps you through all that. First published in 1872 in the collection Flyleaves by C.S. Calverley, In the Gloaming. In the gloaming, to be roaming, where the crested waves are foaming, and the shy mermaidens combing locks that ripple to their feet. When the gloaming is, I never made the ghost of an endeavour to discover, but whatever, were the hour, it would be sweet. To their feet, I say, for Leech's sketch indisputably teaches that the mermaids of our beaches do not end in ugly tales, nor have homes among the corals, but are shod with neat balmorals, an arrangement no one quarrels with, as many might with scales. Sweet to roam beneath a shady cliff, of course with some young lady, Lalage, Neera, Haidee, or Elaine, or Marianne. Love, you dear, delusive dream you, very sweet your victims deem you, when heard only by the seamew, they talk all the stuff one can. Sweet to haste, a licensed lover, to Miss Pinkerton, the glover, having managed to discover what is dear Neera's size. Perhaps to touch that wrist so slender, as your tiny gift you tender, and to read your no offender in those laughing hazel eyes. Then to hear her call you Harry, when she makes you fetch and carry. Oh, young men about to marry, what a blessed thing it is to be photographed together, cased in pretty Russian leather. Hear her gravely doubting whether they have spoilt your honest fizz. Then to bring your plighted fair one, first a ring, a rich and rare one, next a bracelet if she'll wear one, and a heap of things beside, and serenely bending o'er her to inquire if it would bore her to say when her own adorer may aspire to call her bride. Then the days of courtship over, with your wife to start for Dover, or Dieppe, and live in clover evermore, whate'er befalls. For I've read in many a novel that unless they've souls that grovel, folks prefer, in fact, a hovel to your dreary marble halls, to sit happy married lovers, Phyllis trifling with a plover's egg, while Corydon uncovers with a grace the Sally Lunn, or dissects the lucky pheasant, that I think were passing pleasant, as I sit alone at present, dreaming darkly of a dun. A poem from me to you, University Humour, from C.S. Calverley, in the gloaming. I think he means done there in the Gaelic sense of a fort, i.e. a fortress safe from the seductions of the female. In the gloaming. Ah, but the word gloaming does not exist for University Humour. Twilight, dusk, the half-light that lingers. 2 years later, in 1874, a lady called Meta Orrid wrote a poem with the exact same title, In the Gloaming. And round about that time, another lady, Annie Fortescue Harrison, went to stay at Hillsborough Castle in County Down in Ireland, the home of the Marquess of Downshire. She fell in love with the Marquess's younger son, Lord Arthur Hill. But plain Miss Harrison thought the difference in social class too wide for anything to come of her love, and so she left Hillsborough Castle rather suddenly and went back to England. And still pining for Lord Arthur, she found solace in Meta Orrid's poem, In the Gloaming. It spoke to her aching heart, and she decided to set it to music, and the song became a big hit. It was best to leave you thus, dear, best for you and best for me. Evelyn Tubb with Jeremy Barlow at the piano in The Gloaming, a poem by Meta Orrid, set to music in 1877 by Annie Fortescue Harrison because of her love for the younger son of the Marquess of Downshire. The story has a happy ending. Lord Arthur was in London. He was at one time or another in the government as controller of the household, and he went to a concert. And at the concert, he heard In the Gloaming and discovered that it was by the young lady who had left Hillsborough Castle so suddenly. That led to him being reintroduced to Annie. They married almost immediately, and notwithstanding her concerns about the differences in class, Miss Harrison became Lady Arthur Hill, and very happily so. A couple of years back, I chanced to visit with my daughter Hillsborough Castle, which is now the Queen's official residence in Northern Ireland. It was given to the Crown by the 7th Marquess of Downshire in 1922, and among other delights, it boasts the largest rhododendron bush in the world. When I mentioned that as we drove into the grounds, my daughter was extremely unimpressed. Then she saw it and went, "Wow, that is totally awesome." And it is, it's huge. So she went and stood inside it, which I don't think you're actually meant to do. The other thing she loved was the 130-foot pillar that just goes straight up in a scrubby field of cow pasture. So a pillar in the middle of a cow field with a statue of the 3rd Marquess of Downshire on the top, dominating the gardens of an adjoining subdivision of modest homes. And my daughter thought that was spectacular. And when we got back to New Hampshire, she wanted me to put up an overpowering pillar with me on top of it, just to annoy the neighbours. I may yet do it. We are exploring different takes on The Gloaming. Undergraduate cynicism from England, then shattered love in Ireland. It's a Scottish word, so how about we close it out with the view from Scotland?
I've seen lots of bonny lasses on my travels wide, but my heart is centered new on bonny Kate McBride. Although I'm no a fella that would throw a word away, I'm surprised sometimes myself at all I've got to say. Roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming, roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde. The sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming. One night in the gloaming, we were tripping side by side. I kissed her twice and I asked her once if she would be my bride. She was shy and so was I, we were both the same. But I got brave and braver on the journey coming home. Roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming, roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming. Oh, I tell you, last night after strolling, we got in at 9:30. And sitting at the kitchen fire, I asked her to be mine. When she promised, I got up and I danced the heel and fling. I've just been to the jeweler's and I've bought her a bonny wee ring. Oh, Roman and the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde. Roman in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming. Roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde. Roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming. Roman and the gloaming, man, when there's nobody there but your Sally.
At the time he wrote that, 1911, Sir Harry Lauder was the highest paid performer in the world. That would make him like, I don't know, Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande. I don't even want to think about it. Roman in a crowded gloaming with, respectively, Sir Harry Lauder, before that, Meta Orrid, and Annie Fortescue Harrison, and we started with C.S. Calverley. Let us stay in the gloaming, but get a little more metaphorically crepuscular. This month is the centennial of Philip Larkin, born August 9th, 1922, in Coventry. I can't claim to have known him, although we sat across the aisle from each other at a memorial service once. He was famous in a way modern poets rarely are. First, for a verse that came to define an entire cultural moment, indeed the hinge between a discarded past and a new era. The opening lines of Annus Mirabilis: sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me. Between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. You know the Beatles? The ban on Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence is less well remembered, but the court case that ended it was seismic in 1963, and the question to the jury by prosecuting counsel Mervyn Griffith Jones, QC, is it a book that you would wish your wife or your servants to read? That question passed into the language as a brilliant accidental précis of the world that had been cast off. The other famous Larkin line that passed into general currency is the opening of This Be the Verse. They bleep you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. To be honest, I prefer Adrian Mitchell's parody. I didn't care for Mr. Mitchell and he loathed me. But his first line here is ingenious. He alters just one letter in Larkin's original. They tuck you up, your mum and dad. They read you Peter Rabbit too. They give you all the treats they had and add some extra just for you. I hope your mum and dad incline more to the tucking up than the bleeping up. Those lines are justly famous, but if they're all you know... By the way, I did bowdlerise the bleeping up in the original... Philip Larkin uses the full-blooded Anglo-Saxon. Those lines are justly famous, but if they're all you know of Larkin, you'd assume he was a man of his times, glib and certain. There are other poems in the Larkin oeuvre. This is an early work from 1954, but a prescient one. An Englishman stops at an English church. The doors are always unlocked, or they were then, and so he goes inside. He is not a believer, not at all. But he discerns in his own curiosity about the building a premonition of what comes next, or at least the question of what comes next, when a slowly dying faith is finally a dead faith, and a post-Christian England is here. The title is a pun, church-going, as in what churchgoers do, people who go to church on Sunday, but also church-going, in a sense that the entire church, the entire faith, is going. First published in 1954 in the collection The Less Deceived by Philip Larking, Church Going. Once I'm sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church, matting seats and stone, and little books, sprawlings of flowers, cut for Sunday, brownish now, some brass and stuff. Up at the holy end, the small, neat organ, and a tense, musty, unignorable silence, brewed God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new. Cleaned or restored? Someone would know. I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring large-scale verses and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book, donate an Irish sixpence, reflect the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did. In fact, I often do, and always end much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for, wondering too, when churches fall completely out of use, what we shall turn them into, if we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment plate and picks in locked cases, and let the rest rent-free to rain and sheep. Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or after dark will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on, in games, in riddles, seemingly at random, but superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky. A shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rude lofts were? Some ruined bibber, randy for antique, or Christmas addict counting on a whiff of gown and bands and organ pipes and myrrh? Or will he be my representative? Bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub because it held unspilt so long and equably what since is found only in separation, marriage and birth and death, and thoughts of these for whom was built this special shell. For though I've no idea what this accoutred frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house, on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognised and robed as destinies, and that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising, a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round. Oh my, Spem in Allium, Hope in Any Other, a 40-part motet composed by Thomas Tallis around 1570 for eight choirs of five voices apiece. It was sung there by the Tallis scholars, and it was a lifelong favourite of Philip Larkin's, a man who described himself as an Anglican agnostic, nevertheless understood that much of the greatest art of the Western world would never have been written, never have been composed, painted, sculpted, built, had not their creators believed in God and wished to glorify him. That Larkin poem, Churchgoing, by the way, is tricky to read. It rhymes, but the choice of rhymed words trips up the sense and the flow of the thought. I assume that's deliberate to throw you off. While we are in crepuscular mood, I was thinking about Jerusalem, which will be bellowed out at the last night of the proms at the Royal Albert Hall in a couple of weeks. Sir Hubert Parry's music is magnificent, and so is Sir Edward Elgar's orchestration. And they have transformed the words, as was Robert Bridges' intent when he asked Sir Hubert to set them. William Blake wrote the original poem, and it was barely known for its first century until the Great War started in August 1914 and then ground on and on with great loss of life. Robert Bridges was the poet laureate at the time, and he included Blake's poem in a patriotic anthology designed to dissuade public opinion from souring on the war. And it occurred to him that those words would make great words for a patriotic song. So he took it to Hubert Parry and asked the composer to give it a big singable setting for an upcoming Right to Fight concert at the Queen's Hall. And Sir Hubert, who wasn't entirely on board with the certainties of the Right to Fight campaign, nevertheless obliged and turned in the commission a couple of weeks later with the words, "Here's a tune for you, old chap. Do what you like with it. You can't argue with its success, but I hear nuances in the words that I don't hear in the words with music." So, with your permission, according to one version, the poem is premised on the apocryphal tale that Jesus, accompanied by Joseph of Arimathea, travelled to England in his short lifetime and visited Glastonbury. There was no rock festival back then, so presumably it was easier to find accommodation. Now it's like Bethlehem during festival season. According to another, that apocryphal tale never existed until William Blake's poem. So we have the poet to thank for it. The first half of the piece is four questions. The second half responds as every Christian should. Regardless of whether those feet walked here literally, we should resolve to build Jerusalem among these dark satanic mills. Written by William Blake, circa 1804, for the preface to his epic, Milton, A Poem in Two Books. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear. O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. if you're used to Sir Edward Elgar's familiar orchestration of Sir Hubert Parry's grand composition, that will sound perhaps a little understated, but I happen to like it. Jerusalem, played by Stephen Isserlis on cello, Connie Shee on piano, and not just any old cello, but a so-called trench cello that looks like a kind of ammunition box with a stick sticking out either end. Its original owner, Harold Triggs of the Royal Sussex Regiment, played it in those terrible trenches on the Western Front back when Jerusalem was in its first flush of popularity during the Great War. And that version rather suits the times a century on from Sir Hubert's composition. Jerusalem was not builded here. Christianity is mostly gone, and so, incredibly, are the dark satanic mills, which have all moved to China, where they're even more dark and satanic. Ah, we're getting too crepuscular. To close, let's go back to where we came in. As my compatriot Sir Charles Roberts put it, the year's at full. I said there were very few pieces called August, but this is one of them, Tchaikovsky.
Mark Stein's Sunday Poems is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.